Okay, me too. There we go. Okay. Doo-doo-doo. Yep, I'm up. Okay. Great. Ooh. Okay. Here we go. 114. Ready? This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, a great company that provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education organizations. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Shobi. This show is brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Bradley, good evening.
It is a beautiful day here in Chattanooga. It's welcome about 70 back. Degrees. It's close to 70, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we are not feeling the winter weather just yet.
No, me neither. It's let's hear for global warming, right?
Yeah, we had a terrible winter last year, so we'll see what happens this year. Of course, winter doesn't start here at, I think, officially December 22nd. So,
all right, okay.
So, yeah, now before we get started, I have found a great app that I have fallen in love with.
Okay.
And if you're listening to podcasts, then you obviously like spoken word, and it's called Umano, I believe is how you pronounce it. And what it does is they take articles around the web and then they have voice narrators read them. And so you can download them to your phone or stream them as well. You have to be a premium member to download. But so you actually get to listen to articles online read by semi-professional narrators. I mean, I think anyone can apply to be a narrator. So I'm not going to say like they only hire people that read audiobooks for a living as narrators, but it's not like Joe Schmo off the street reading his blog article. And it's really, really interesting. It's free to try it. If you're a premium member, you can download articles. If you're a free member, you cannot download and you can only listen to 7 articles a day on your phone. But it's pretty cool. We'll have a link in the show notes. They have a neat referral program where every time someone that you refer joins, you get an additional 7 days of premium. So I have like 40 days of premium right now. So mm-hmm. it's actually really, really interesting. And you tell them what you're interested in, and then they kind of personalize the stories for you.
Okay, that sounds pretty cool. I mean, you can imagine that would be a useful tool in the classroom as well for if you have students who have, say, dyslexia or visual impairment or something, and you wanted to use some articles that are online, you could see how that would be quite useful too.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Instapaper added a feature similar to this in their, I think, update for iOS 8. Of course, it's obviously the computerized voice reading it. And then right. I know one of our favorite apps, VoiceDream, can also you can load in Instapaper articles, load in PDFs, and it'll read it. The great thing about this is it's an actual narrator.
Yeah, it's an actual human recording, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm kind of starting to appreciate like proper enunciation. Like, one of the programs that a lot of churches in the South do for children is called Awanas, and so my 4-year-old son is doing it. They had to memorize a Bible verse every week. And the one he had to memorize for this week, the sentence had 2 commas in it. And mm-hmm. so like how you say how you stop and have your pauses and how you enunciate the words and things like that really matters for that verse. And that's one of the things that this app would get versus just a computerized reading.
Yeah, most definitely. And it's interesting as well. It's something that's a wee bit of a touchy subject in schools in the UK is that many apps that speak to the students speak with an American accent, and in Scotland sometimes it's even a wee bit touchy subject that some of them speak with an English accent, of course, because Scotland, Uber Alice, etc.
Yeah, here in America, you either have a southern voice like me, you have a northern twang, or you have a kind of a California accent. Those are your big three.
Yeah, it's funny. It took me years to even realize that there was a difference between American accents. There was just like American and not American. And it's only, I mean, I've been visiting America for like 15 years now, and I've only just really started to kind of understand and notice differences. But I was pretty happy. I met a guy from New Orleans recently, and thanks to our shared interest in the True Detective series, I actually sort of quite impressed him by pinpointing his accent to the exact city that he was from.
Well, what's the old Jeff Foxworthy joke? He's a Southern comedian. He says that we make up words in the South. We say things like, hey, G yet? No, Jew? You don't too? I, you know, we just leave off complete parts of words.
Yep.
But that's the old saying is Southern financial advisors don't get very far because no one wants to trust their money to people that talk like us. So, yeah, before we get started tonight, I think our first sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamp Software. Jamp's been a sponsor for a long, long time now. They have really been a great partner of ours. Fraser and I both use them. And if you need Apple management at your school, your organization, that's who you want to go to. They, for Macs, iPads, iPhones, Apple TVs, they have a great app called Casper Focus that allows teachers to take control of their iPad deployment in their classroom from their iPad. Allows them to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams with an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their classroom, and choose to distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay. They have two options for deploying it. You can deploy it on your own server. It really works on just about anything, or they'll even host it for you. They have a JSS hosted option, and so if you just want a turnkey solution, they have that for you too. If you want to learn more about Jamp Software, go to outofschool.net and click the link. That's a special link, and it lets them know that you came to them from our show. So thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show this week.
Can I just follow up on one thing that I said in the last show about Jamf? You remember we were talking about Bluetooth beacons and what you could use them for in conjunction with your Casper server?
Yes.
And I said that it was possible to use the presence of a Bluetooth beacon to prompt an iOS device to upload its inventory to Casper. That's actually not true. I had a call with John Miller from Jamf just talking about the possibilities around iBeacon, and I just checked in with him about that question, and he says that is true, but it's only true for Macs, right? So if you have a Mac running Casper's data collector program, you can use an iBeacon to prompt the Mac to upload its inventory because Jamf have a little application on your Mac that will do that. But for iOS, that's not possible at the moment and won't be possible without some help from Apple to make that a feature of the OS and the MDM protocol on iOS.
That seems like something that Apple would consider adding as they make an iBeacon push.
Yeah, I mean, the appeal is obvious, right?
So we had really two topics for today. We're going to do a little follow-up towards the end of the show. We have a handful of follow-up that we need to get to. But, you know, if our listeners follow you on the Twitter, which mm-hmm. I recommend they do, you know, you have the 13,000 followers to my 2,000. I'm a little jealous. I assume you bought most of those.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are spammers. There's about 10 real people, I think.
I figured I have like 3 real followers at this point. So you wonder what the ratio is for like for every 1,000 followers you have. Like probably realistically, probably 300 to 400 of them are bots.
Quite possibly, yeah.
But so you've been tweeting a lot about Chromebook, and mm-hmm. you're specifically your Dell 11, and you've been using it quite a bit. And I'm sure you've gotten a ton of feedback. So we spent 2 episodes talking about Chromebook from a practicality standpoint, but you've actually been using it day to day. And so we kind of want to report on that, the pros mm-hmm. and cons, and then we'll move into the feedback. So I guess take us away.
Yeah. So I decided, as I mentioned in the Chromebook show, is one of the things that I had been frustrated with in my own experience with Chromebook is that they all appeared to be very slow. And I'd had the Samsung Series 3 and then the HP 11. And so as part of the show, I was doing some more research and I realized that, in fact, what I had bought in the HP 11 was basically the slowest Chromebook that had ever been made in the history of the world, and decided to give the Chrome experience another whirl with a machine that was actually up to scratch in terms of its performance. So I looked at all the reviews that I could find, and I picked out 3 that I thought looked like good candidates. And they were the Dell 11, which is the one that ended up kind of being the winner, the Acer C720P, which was pretty close second, and then the Lenovo N20P, which was kind of in the middle of the two. And what I did was I got my iPhone 6 Plus, my iPad Air 2, my MacBook Air, these 3 Chromebooks, and my old HP 11, and I ran a number of benchmarks on both of them. And I used Peacekeeper, which is a kind of broad spectrum browser test. I used SunSpider, which is a JavaScript benchmark, and I used Octane as well, which is another kind of JavaScript benchmark. And I ran them all several times and sort of averaged them all out. And what I found was that, of course, the fastest thing I have is my MacBook Air, but the next fastest thing was a kind of a toss-up depending on which benchmark you were looking at. Sometimes it was the iPad Air, sometimes it was the Dell 11. And what I found was that overall the Dell 11 was 75% of the performance of my MacBook Air. So that's a computer that costs £230. And on these benchmarks, and I take these benchmarks as not necessarily being a true measure of the exact hardware performance, but they're a practical measure of your experience because everything is filtered through the complexity of the browser layer. I found that the Dell 11 was offering almost the same performance as my MacBook here. Not quite, but it certainly wasn't one-fifth of the performance, but it was one-fifth of the price.
If you look at just true ROI, that's pretty good. I mean, if you were buying a lawnmower and one costs $1,000 and one costs $200 and the one that costs $200 was 75% as powerful, that's a pretty good value.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And I think that's important to note is it's not necessarily just about the price to performance. It's about the value it brings at the cost, and especially when you're looking at buying these things in mass.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. You've got to scale that experience up a little bit. So the other two laptops, the Acer and the Lenovo, are both touchscreen, and the Dell is not. So that's one of the knocks against it in that lineup of three. The Lenovo also has this foldback feature where you can sort of open the screen to like some like 270 degrees and put it kind of keyboard, if you imagine keyboard down, and then it's kind of standing up like an iPad would stand up, and you can use it that way as well. I didn't particularly find that a compelling feature, nor did I find the touchscreen particularly compelling, although it was reasonably usable. But in the end, I just decided that I was going to keep the Dell on the basis of just pure performance, because that's what I was looking for. I mean, I've used Chromebooks before that are very cheap, in the case of the Samsung, or very nicely built in the case of the HP. But what I was looking for here was how does performance affect the Chrome OS experience? And that was why I chose to keep the Dell. I also kind of like the plastic better on the Dell. It's got a kind of slightly rubberized finish, whereas the Acer is pretty hard, shiny plastic, and the Lenovo is a little bit in between the two. So these are all Intel-based Chromebooks. That's why they're interesting compared to the HP and the Samsung, which are both ARM-based Chromebooks. So these are three Intel-based processors. And the Dell and the Acer were basically the same performance. The Dell just shaded it in every measurement, but not by much. And then the Lenovo was a noticeable step below those top two, but it was still faster than the HP. And then further on down the line, we had the HP and the Samsung as well. So after that, after deciding which one I was going to keep, I returned the other two and I started using the Dell. So set it up, you know, insofar as it was set up is on a Chromebook, you know, I logged in and just got on with it. And then I started to use it at school. So I decided to do an experiment, which was that I would just leave my Mac at home and I would take the Chromebook to school. And it actually really went really well. Now, I've had Google Cloud Print set up for quite a long time, running on the same machine that runs Printopia for our AirPrint printing in school. On the Mac, Google Cloud Print is built into Chrome. So basically, you set it up in the advanced preferences of Chrome. You add whatever printers the computer can see on your network, and they are then made available through Google Cloud Print. I think, as I mentioned on a previous show, I haven't still yet worked out exactly how you share that with a group en masse, but I think there may be other ways to do that.
Yeah, it actually is a huge concern of ours is how we would make our printers available via Cloud Print. You had a long conversation with our sales rep for our printer company today. We're talking about lack of drivers for Yosemite and things like that. And he informed me that new drivers are made available for new printers first, but even though we're still in the lease, but whatever. And that was one of my frustrations it doesn't seem like they are expanding to new technologies like AirPrint and like cloud printing. And so that's something, you know, what we really want is an app like Printopia on the Mac that can just make those cloud printers. Maybe it's like it would work within your domain. Maybe it's anyone that signed into, you know, an @brainerbaptist.org domain can see these printers would hook to this computer. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's something on the web, on the help files, that sort of says, for setting up your cloud print printers for an education organization, contact us, you know, which I suppose means you're buying a license or something at that point. But for basically what I'm doing at the moment is I'm just using it myself. So I'm logged into my Google account. It's my school Google account, but it's still my Google account on the Mac that is running Cloud Print in Chrome. And then I'm obviously logged into that Google account on my Chromebook, and the two can see each other. So that is working for me. but I haven't figured out yet how to scale out to the rest of the school. Not that Andy needs it yet, but in principle, a few people might want to use it. So what did I find that was a problem? Right. Number one, in my admin and IT class, where the kids are using Office and Macs, basically, what I've basically been doing is the way that the course works is that a lot of the assessments are based on the exam board send us a pack of files that we have to sort of give to the kids, and then they're sort of half-finished documents and they have to complete them in, according to a certain set of instructions. And the way I've been doing that up till now is I've got them all on my Mac and I use Apple Remote Desktop to just copy them onto those users' desktop computers, which is it, or the desktop of their computer, which is straightforward and fast and easy and everything. And there's not really any an exact analog to doing that off your Chromebook, even though I had all the files accessible to me in my Google Drive. It wasn't clear to me how I was going to download them and get them across and so on. So basically what I did was I shared them with the students, because all the students have got a Google account. I shared it with their Google accounts, and then I had them log into Google Drive on their desktop and download the file from there and put it in the right folder. So it wasn't a fundamental barrier. There's many ways around that. It's just that I hadn't really set myself up to do any of them. And I hadn't really set up the use of Google Drive as a standard operating procedure in that class yet, because I just normally fired them over through Apple Remote Desktop. So that's something that I'd probably need to change a little bit, adjust a little bit to make sure I get that right. But primarily, that was it. And of course, it doesn't work with our Apple TV. We mentioned AirParrot is available for Chrome OS. I tested that out. It's really, really sluggish, but it does work. What's actually much better, and this might be interesting to you with your interest in streaming TV devices, Bradley, is along with all of these Chromebooks, I also picked up a Chromecast. And I've been having a little playoff with that against the Apple TV. And you may be surprised what happened next, as they say on BuzzFeed.
One of the things that I thought was interesting that you said earlier is, I don't think you meant it interesting when you said it. You said, I set it up, really just as a matter of logging in. And so you think about redeployments with that. You think, let's say you've been on Chromebook at 3 years, and then you're on your redeployment. It literally is just handing the computers to them in the box, and you just sign in.
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, and it's not that way with the Mac. If you've got Time Machine, you've got to restore from Time Machine. And that's not that that's difficult, but you've got to know how to do it. Or if you're syncing your home folder to an Apple server, you're probably going to be sad. It's probably going to error out on you 1,000 times. Yeah. You just think about just fundamental details. And you tweeted, I guess, last night. We're recording on Thursday the 4th. So I think you tweeted on Wednesday the 3rd about iOS disaster recovery of supervised devices. It's never really worked right.
Yeah. I mean, I had that situation where a kid in school just, cracked the screen of her iPad, and I was trying to restore it. And I had an afternoon off. I was doing various administrative tasks, and one of them was to set up her iPad with a repair iPad. And basically, I was fortunate that she had actually kept her iCloud backups up to date, so it was a quick case of just updating the backup with what she'd done that morning. And then the next step was to get one of her spare iPads, plug it into Apple Configurator, supervise it, which involves downloading the new iOS, which takes about half an hour, and then supervising it on Apple Configurator, taking it off Configurator, going through half the setup, trying to remember exactly which step in the 20-step process you have to stop at, and then reconnect the machine to Configurator and then supervise it again. Otherwise, everything goes wrong. And the part of the problem is I always forget exactly which step it is. For reference, it's the step where you choose your iCloud backup. Before you actually select the backup set, you have to reconnect it to Configurator and supervise it again. Otherwise, everything goes to hell. And then you obviously restore the backup from iCloud, which takes 5-10 minutes for the data. And then once you've completed the setup assistant, you've got to re-download all the apps. So the fundamental architectural difference here is that the Chromebook has very little local state. That's why they've got 16 gig SSDs for the most part. And it's all cloud state. And the cloud state doesn't really impact on the local storage. Whereas iOS is mostly local state with a little bit of cloud syncing and backup. And that's a fundamental architectural difference between the two platforms, and it plays directly into this issue of the length of time taken to do a backup. So I timed it just out of interest, and it took me fully 55 minutes to go from being handed a broken iPad to handing back a mostly completely working replacement. And that's another point, is that one of the other issues with iCloud backup is that sometimes, say you've installed an application, and that backup includes the fact that that app is installed on the device. If you then restore from iCloud, the app binaries are not actually part of your backup. What happens is that the iOS device will re-download all the apps from the store that it knew it had installed before. Problem is, if any of those apps have disappeared from the store, you don't get a download of them again. So you may end up having a device, the new device, having fewer apps than the one that was replaced, because some apps can't be downloaded again. That's actually quite a big issue if you think about it. You know, I can't completely restore this device one-to-one. The only way to do that properly is to sync it back to iTunes, copy all the apps over, copy them all back again. But again, if in this kind of deployment model, you're not doing that. So go figure.
It makes me sad.
It does. Let me tell you about Chromecast, though. Pretty interesting. You know, the main reason I got the Chromecast was, A, I didn't really know very much about it, and B, it was £30. So I was like, well, what the heck? Just get one of them. I was very fortunate that my classroom projector has two HDMI inputs. So I've got basically side by side a Chromebook and a Chromecast and an Apple TV, both plugged into the same projector over HDMI. And the way it's set up is quite interesting, because the Chromecast has no remote control. It's basically completely controlled over the network. So what happens is, when you plug it in, the device radiates its own Wi-Fi network, and then you connect your device, your phone, your iPad, whatever, to that network. And then before you do this, you download an app called the Chromecast app. And the Chromecast app basically exists for you to manage things like the name of each Chromecast device on your network, and also give them the actual password for your real Wi-Fi network. So I connected to it, put in our Wi-Fi network password, and I was done. Right, that was it. The Chromecast was up and running. And it downloaded a software update, I think, and then that was it done. So connected all back to the network. And then what I found really interesting was that the Chromecast works completely differently from the Apple TV. And this is something I hadn't quite appreciated the impact of, although I understood how it worked. And it was that the Chromecast, what you are basically, when you cast to a Chromecast, and I'm making air quotes here because that's the terminology that it uses, that's the word for sending something to the Chromecast. When you cast something, you're not actually sending the content from your device to the Chromecast. You're essentially sending an instruction that says, start streaming this thing. And it could be, you know, a video URL or whatever, or a web tab or something. And what I found was that, despite having had all the issues with AirPlay that we've talked about in previous shows, the Chromecast video streaming was basically flawless. I mean, it just was absolutely rock solid. And it started quickly, and it would pause, and it would play. But what I hadn't realized was, because of that architectural approach, where it's actually a device that's streaming directly from the network, you can then go away and do something else, right? The only involvement of your device in that playback is the fact that you told it to start. And you have control of stopping it and pausing it and stuff as well. But I could then, say I start streaming a YouTube video to the Chromecast, I can then go to another app on my iPhone, and it doesn't interfere or interrupt the stream at all. That's really cool, I thought. That's a huge benefit.
Your device is really a remote at that point.
Mm.
It's just, but yeah, it's like sending a stop-start command with the instructions. You just wonder, is that something that, you know, Apple needs to look at? Of course, if you've got something like a movie on a device you're trying to AirPlay, obviously that doesn't really work unless it's backed up to iCloud and they can stream it from iCloud somehow.
Yeah, I think in principle, if you're streaming a video from the actual official videos app, you can put your iPad to sleep or go to another app and it will still continue to play. But I don't think that's true for other apps. So like BBC iPlayer or Netflix or something, if I remember right, that's a limitation of those other apps. So that was the video part of it, which is quite interesting. And then the other thing you can do is you can cast a tab from your Chromebook to the Chromecast stick. And the way that works is there's a Chrome extension that you install that puts a Chromecast button in the toolbar, and whatever page you're on or whatever tab you're looking at, you just hit the button and it comes down to the list of the devices on your network, which you only had one, and then you can send the HTML of that page to the Chromecast. And it does seem to, in this case, it does seem to be that your device is actually streaming its rendering of that HTML page to the Chromecast. Because although what you see on the Chromecast is you basically see a full screen view of the HTML page that you're looking at. You don't see the tab, you don't see the Chrome of the browser, and you don't even see the cursor that you're using. So that's quite a funny thing in the classroom, because you sort of, your habit is sort of to use your cursor to point at things on the screen, but you can't do that. But what it does do is if you mouse over a link, the link on the screen will become underlined or highlighted or whatever the CSS effect is that when you roll over a link, that will be shown on the screen, but you don't see the cursor. So it's kind of a little bit strange that way. However, that was really useful as well, because the nice thing about it is that you can then go and work away in another tab and still have that tab on the screen. So it's not device mirroring in the way that you would do it on iOS. So in iOS, when you've got the full screen up and you're showing a web page, if you change to any other app, that all gets shown on the screen. Whereas with Chromecast, it's just that one tab that you put up, which is really nice, because then you can, you know, if the kids are, you know, working from that thing on the screen, you can go away and, you know, check your email or look up another document or whatever it is you need to do without showing that information on the screen as well. So it's different from Apple TV. Much more reliable, much cheaper, and in some ways more convenient, but in other ways less convenient. Because one thing it's not at all useful for is it's not useful for demonstrating how to use Chrome OS, because it doesn't show any of the Chrome UI. It just shows the HTML. So that was one thing. And the other limitation I found was that Chrome for iOS doesn't support this. You can only do this from, say, a Chromebook or a desktop installation of Chrome. With mobile devices, it requires that the site somehow support Chromecasting, and as far as I could find, I couldn't really find any sites that actually were. But what I also found was that some other third-party video apps on iOS, such as YouTube, Netflix, BBC iPlayer, all support Chromecast as an equal peer with AirPlay. So that was really interesting to note, that there was actually a bunch of built-in stuff on my iPad already that would work on Chromecast. So it's interesting that, because if you use a lot of, say, YouTube video, you might actually be better off to have a Chromecast instead of an Apple TV.
Before we move on, let's thank our second sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks from Shobee. Shobee is an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobee, teachers can quickly and easily assign and collect and review student work on their iPads. They can then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobee from thousands of compatible apps or by completing assignments with Shobee's built-in tools. Shobee keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notification. Now, Shobee, it is free to try. They have a basic version. It's completely free, and teachers can try it out with their students in just a few minutes. And if you go to outofschool.net, you'll see a link for the Shobee free edition. They also have Shobee Pro, and they're offering a special deal for school administrators listening to this podcast. You can buy Shobee Pro for 5 of your teachers, and they will give you a bonus 5 teachers for free. That's 10 total teachers, all of their students for the price of 5 on Shobee Pro for a full year. Visit shobee.com/outofschool for details. We'll have a link in the show notes at outofschool.net. But that's Shobee with an IE at the end, shobee.com/outofschool. Thanks to Shobee for sponsoring the show this week. Well, it's, you know, you can even find the Chromecast on sale for $25. And the rumor is there's a new one coming out very soon.
I think it would be fascinating if Apple were to create something like an Apple TV Express, which is basically the Chromecast idea, but only for AirPlay. You know, the Apple TV's got channels and rental and all that stuff, but what if you just made something that price, that size, that only just did AirPlay mirroring? I think that would be interesting.
And it worked.
And actually worked, yeah. That would be another thing.
Well, yeah. And I think it's we joke, but you typically...
It's not funny.
Yeah, it's definitely not funny in the classroom. No. And you don't see... You know, Google's got a lot of faults, but you typically don't see their technology erode over time.
Yep.
But with Apple, you sometimes take 2 steps forward, then 1 step back, or 1 step forward and 3 steps back with things like reliability of AirPlay, just little details like that. And those are the kind of things that Google has typically obsessed over. I mean, how long does something take to load? The milliseconds. That's Google's strategy, where Apple is typically more concerned about the process, the user experience. And that's not to say that Google is not and Apple is not concerned about reliability. But in the classroom, those kind of seconds matter. I mean, I was something today I was dealing with was like, and this is not necessarily Apple's fault, but when you plug up a projector to a Mac running Mavericks and on, it defaults to a multiple display mode. And so the teachers, typically, they'll just like, they don't know what's going on. They don't know to drag it over. And it's like one of those things, to me, when you plug up a projector, it should prompt you to say, do you want to mirror your display or extend your monitor onto this display?
Yeah, you know, I had an interesting story along that line. We had somebody come in and speak to us externally, and I was actually taking the class that this person was going to speak to, and I hadn't forgotten they were coming, but I had forgotten that I had agreed that I would provide them with a laptop in order to present. So I ended up in another classroom, one that wasn't my classroom. It had a flat screen TV instead of a projector, and all I had with me was my Chromebook, and this presenter shows up and he's like, here's my USB stick. Where's the computer to set it up? And I was just like, this is a disaster. I've completely forgotten that we were going to do this and blah, blah, blah. But I thought, well, and the point was I only had my Chromebook with me. I didn't have my Mac. So I was like, well, what am I going to do here? So I just plugged the Chromebook into the HDMI cable in the TV because the Dell has a full-size HDMI port on the side. Plugged in the guy's USB stick, opened it up, and just double-clicked the PowerPoint file and it worked. I actually opened the Google Sheets, converted the file, and played it, and that was it. I was like, okay, that was pretty cool. This thing got me out of a jam that I thought was going to be a big problem. So I was pretty impressed with it after that as well. That was cool.
It seems like Chromebook is doing the things that Apple is struggling with currently. It's like it's hitting all the sweet spots of things, little annoyances we're having with the Apple ecosystem. It's doing them right.
It does seem that way. There's things that Apple are also doing right. I mean, I don't want to get too heavily down on Apple, but it's hard to overstate how much of a problem this reliability issue has become with Apple software. The hardware is great. The hardware service is great. You know, I can rock up to the Genius Bar, get it swapped, no problem. Okay, it costs me too much money to do that, in my opinion, but still, at least it's quick. But where we're seeing problem after problem is just in the software. And it's things like, and in the classroom, it's things like Apple TV reliability, backup and restore. It's things like, caching server working for operating system updates. It's things like control over operating system updates and pushing them out. It's about access to all different features in MDM. It's things like that that I think Apple could be doing more on. And they're being quite conservative in releasing some of those features. And quite frankly, they're just dropping the ball in the quality problem at the moment. And at some point, I just think nothing's more important than reliability. If you're standing up in front of a class of 25, 30 students, many of whom are quite keen for a good carry-on instead of an actual lesson, and you're at the front just fumbling about with technology. And I mean, I'm good at this stuff, and I still can't make my Apple TV stay connected to any iOS device for more than 5 minutes at a time. And there's nothing I know how to do about it. There's no debugging tools. There's no nothing. That's a problem. You know, pity the people who don't understand the technology. I have a certain sympathy for the complexity of networking, but I'm rapidly losing that sympathy because I'm fed up with this whole problem. And I think that, you know, reliability, as we've said, is something that has been key to my experience so far with the Chrome ecosystem. And as long as that continues, the more and more keen I get to think about that stuff. And I stood there and spent those 50 minutes today trying to partially restore an iPad. I was like, do you know what? If this was a Chrome device, I would have been done 45 minutes ago, including unwrapping it and taking the box into the bin. So it's things like that that just sort of focus your mind, I think.
Continuity and handoff are great, but we'd trade that for reliability.
Yeah, and those things are irrelevant in school anyway because nobody's got three devices, you know? Everybody's got one device, and the problem is that internally it doesn't work well enough with itself, you know? continuity and handoff are fine for me as a teacher who's got all the devices, but not for the student.
So it's an interesting experiment, and I think as you continue to use it, we'll continue to check in. And I think it's interesting for someone to go all in and not use it for an hour and say, oh, this is neat, but to like actually go all in. You know, I gave one of our third grade teachers my Samsung Chromebook. And I said, I want you to try this for like a week or two. And she was like, well, all my stuff is on the Mac. I said, well, what stuff do you have? She said, well, all my Google stuff. Like it's everything. I said, wait a minute. I said, you come in every day. Like, what do you do? She said, I come in, basically open up Spotify to listen to have music playing in the background. And then I let up Chrome, and that's where I do everything. And I was like, this is basically a Chrome OS commercial.
Yeah.
Because you just sign in and all your stuff is there. She signed in and she was like, why does YouTube have my history there? I said, well, because you're probably signed in on the other computer when you go to YouTube. It's a Google account. You know, everything was just there.
I mean, this is to my mind one of the few possibly existential threats to Apple, is that if everything moves completely to the cloud, then how do you differentiate local work, local native applications? How does iOS remain relevant in a world where the cloud's good enough for most things? And that, I think that's a challenge. And I'm not saying there's no way that can happen, because there's plenty of ways that iOS can stay relevant and powerful. But it's interesting that, you know, for many people, the fastest computer is not necessary anymore. And now for many people, the richest software is not necessary anymore, because what you can do in the cloud is good enough for most people. And the trade-off, and you know, the trade-off of having, you know, £1,200 in my pocket instead of spent on my Mac laptop may actually be quite a good thing for a lot of people. I mean, I can see a lot of teachers in our school who, yeah, they've got the iPad, we're doing the iPad stuff in school, but they've also got a Mac. And the reason they've got a Mac is probably historical, you know, from when we were a school that mostly worked on Macs. And now that all of our stuff is moving to Google Drive, and they're going to come and ask me this year or next year, you know, my Mac's dying, it's from 2004 or whatever, what should I get next? And I'm going to have a really hard time saying you should spend another £1,400 on a Mac, when for most of them, they should just be getting a Chromebook. And they do all their schoolwork on that, and that would be it for them. Interesting times.
You know, transitioning to our next topic, there was an article that came out this week that Chromebooks outsold the iPad in education in Q3.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah. The U.S. is the only thing that matters. You forgot that.
Well, yeah, of course.
Yep. Come on. It's I mean, Black Friday is a national holiday based on a American holiday of being thankful. Then we go and spend all of our money on beat up people for $10 off a waffle maker. But everybody else has to celebrate Black Friday as well.
As is your God-given right, of course.
That's right. So, you know, I think it's interesting. But, you know, you and I have talked to some folks on Twitter about this, and we've talked about it obviously offline. And I think, you know, you and I have talked about this for months. The push to online standardized testing is one of the biggest reasons I think the Chromebook is selling so well. It's dramatically less expensive, and it's 100% compatible.
Yeah, I think different states, I believe, I'm not an expert in things like the Common Core, but my understanding, vague as it is that different states have different standard requirements for the computer that you can use to do that state's online standardized test. And I know in some states, the screen dimension requirements were actually revised in order to accommodate a 9.7-inch iPad as one of the devices that you could use for that. But I believe that other states have specified things like hardware, keyboard, and so on. And once you get to that point where, you know, it's tailor-made to basically be a Chromebook, then it's harder and harder and harder to go for iPad in that situation. And I don't blame anybody for doing that. Obviously, of course, if you're doing online standardized testing, I mean, one of the reasons that online exams are going to be challenging in Scotland is that we simply don't have enough computers in the nation to actually do that for students. So obviously, if you're doing standardized testing, you've got to have enough for the students that are going to be tested. So you're buying potentially a larger number of devices. And of course, the cost advantage of Chromebook is going to be a huge thumb on the scales in favor of Chromebook there, I think. particularly if you're in a state where you have to have a certain big-ish screen that you can only buy an iPad Air or better and not an iPad Mini, then that's an even bigger thumb on the scales for Chromebook because of the cost advantage. So there are reasons behind this, I think. It's not just simply that everybody decided Chromebooks were better straight away, but you can see, it seems clear to me now, and I think this is one of my themes on this whole topic, is that people aren't buying Chromebooks out of ignorance. They're buying them out of an analytical decision that these factors are what we care about and the Chromebook fits the bill. And I understand that. I totally get where people are coming from with that now. Having seen the Chromebooks get powerful enough and the cloud get powerful enough and the management story being at least as strong as iOS and in some cases better, one could still argue that the actual productivity or the creativity that's enabled through Chrome OS is not as great as what you get through iPad. But if you're in a high school and you're looking at SATs and state testing and so on, as we do in our upper school as well, it doesn't seem to me to be the kind of thing to push for, like more and more and more creativity at a time where you're basically just busting your butt trying to get through tests. And it's a very pragmatic decision. That's what I keep coming back to, is the pragmatism of going Chrome OS rather than the sort of idealism of going iOS. And I totally get where people are coming from with that.
It's, you know, as you look at what can bring down Apple's dominance, it's little things. You know, it's not going to be a device comes out tomorrow and it's going to take over the iPad in education. It's a Chromebook here, a Chromebook there. It's a Surface Pro 3 here, a Surface Pro 3 there.
Yeah, and I think in some ways it's the unbundling of the computer, that in fact the cloud is actually becoming the dominant platform, and the question is which cloud is the best, right? And that's a threatening question for Apple, because their cloud is straightforwardly not the best and Google's is much better. And it may be that in some ways what you might call the basis of competition is changing from who can make the best hardware and the best software that you use in that hardware to who's got the best cloud and who gets you access to it in as many places. And you can see that's Microsoft's strategy, right? They're trying to get you access to Office and OneDrive in many, many places, hence free Office on iOS. But Apple's very much not doing that. They're saying, you know, our cloud, our devices, our apps. And I'm having at least as good a Google experience on my iPad as I'm having an Apple experience on my iPad right now. When you could trade off against Apple TV and Chromecast. So, yeah, watch the space. I think everything's still up for play. I don't think Apple has won in any sense at all. They won the first round, but I don't see the next round being as easy for them, and they're going to have to change a lot of things to win people over.
Let's take a moment to thank our final sponsor of the night. This episode is also brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/out of school and use the offer code PUPIL, P-U-P-I-L, at checkout for 10% off. A better web starts with your website. You guys have heard about Squarespace. If you need a website, this is where you need to go. They've got a version 7 out that's brand new back end. It's taking version 6 and making it all the much better. I upgraded day 1. Again, this doesn't change your front end, it's just the back end. Squarespace is perfect for a one-page website all the way up to a huge site that needs e-commerce. They have every plan as e-commerce built right in. If you pay annually, you get a free domain name included, and it's just $8 a month if you want to go month to month. Nothing to manage, nothing to host. You just get to work on content. They have great templates. They're all responsive. If you're nerdy, you can inject JavaScript right into it. They have a great app for the iPhone that you can blog from. It supports Markdown natively. And they have incredible 24/7 email and chat support. No one wants to talk on the phone. You don't, I don't, they don't. Their email and chat support is absolutely fantastic. They're real people you're talking to. Again, if you need a website, go to squarespace.com/out of school and use the offer code PUPIL for 10% off. Again, a better web starts with your website. If we move on into feedback, the LAUSD deployment was back in the case. I believe the FBI is now involved, so that doesn't sound good for anybody.
This is just the deployment that keeps on giving, isn't it?
Yes. It's like it won't die. It's like the Terminator. You think it's dead, and it keeps coming back, and there's more and more issues with it, more and more fraud, it sounds like. And I don't think Apple was uninvolved in any of the fraud. It's really the people there.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, there's been a lot of fingers pointed at Pearson's involvement in the whole thing as well. And I don't know that we should really comment much further on who we think might be at fault, but it's just fascinating. I think one day it would be great if somebody, you know, could just write up what on earth happened there and why it went wrong, because I think it would be a very instructive case study for many future large technology deployments. And it could potentially be that actually nothing happened there. It's just that politically it was important for somebody to destroy this guy or whatever. And in fact, there's actually no real case to answer. It's just people meddling with each other. And I've seen that happen before in other places where there's actually no technical problem with the deployment. There's no educational problem with the deployment. But the local politics are such that somebody has to invent a problem with the deployment in order for, you know, somebody to be politically destroyed in the process or whatever. So I have no insight into what's happened in LA apart from what we've read in the reports. But yeah, the FBI are sticking their finger in now, so it's going to be pretty nasty, I think. I wouldn't like to be in their shoes right now.
So the last part of the show, we have some follow-up. So the first piece of follow-up is from Stephen Black. He was asking if we can list all of our episodes from day one in a single list. Steven, I don't have a great way to do that. Probably, I guess the biggest question I would have is why? Is it for, if you're wanting to download things, you can go to iTunes and you can download all the shows right there from your favorite podcast app. But if you'll get in touch with me on Twitter, let me know exactly what you're wanting. I'll see if I have a better way to give it to you. Yep. Next is from Lawrence Jones. I think we have a couple from Lawrence in here. Mm-hmm. And he commented that he has the same Plantronics Bluetooth earbuds that you do. Mm-hmm. And he was wondering about noise canceling headphones. And so I think you got some, so he was wanting to know your opinions on noise canceling headphones.
Yeah. So from a technical point of view, the way noise canceling headphones work is they have a microphone in the outside of the headphones that listen to your environmental noise, and they basically play it back 180 degrees out of phase into your ears so that you basically get destructive interference. That's about the level of my physics understanding of how they work, but basically it's like shutting off the world. And it's really worth doing a demonstration. If you're flying, a lot of the airport shops have got a kind of booth you can go to where you put the headphones on and they basically play fake engine noise, and then you turn on the headphones and you hear all that just go away. It's really, really incredible. It only works for sort of repetitive, predictable noise. So it doesn't necessarily block out, say, like a crying baby or an incidental noise, but it does block out that constant drone of airline engines. Or I use it at home as well for if the washing machine's on, which is a repetitive noise, I just turn them on and the headphones can cancel them out as well. So they are quite expensive, which is a point I take about a lot of our gift ideas that we had. But they are absolutely worth it if you fly or travel a lot. There is a huge, big benefit.
He was also asking about shared iPads in a school, especially if you're younger students. Yep. You know, how feasible is that? And it's certainly feasible. Obviously, it's more ideal if you can have one-to-one. And then the more you have, the better. If you aren't one-to-one, you will probably be focusing on apps that don't require signing in and signing out. And so you'll need to think of a different way in terms of how you manage long-term data, if any, especially with the younger kids. So yeah. That's just something to think about, is, you know, what it will limit what kind of apps you can use.
I have a recommendation that I normally give to schools who ask this question, and I get the question a lot. And what I've seen, I saw this in a school in New York, actually. I visited a school called Marymount, I think it was called, where what they had done is they had taken class sets of iPads. They had sort of 30 sets of 30. And what they would do is the teachers would schedule a term, so 6 or 8 weeks at a time, where their class would have those iPads exclusively. So they would get a one-to-one experience for, say, one term out of the four in the year or the three or whatever they had. And then at the end of that term, the technician would take, the kids would upload the work they'd done to some kind of file server or Google Drive or whatever. And then the technician would take them back and use Configurator to set them up again for another class that was getting it for the next term, and then somebody else would get it for the next term. So it was basically a big reconfiguration job, maybe three times a year, instead of trying to do it every hour. Because what's not workable is if you take shared iPads and you try and use them exactly the way you used Windows laptops, where they were booked every hour of the day by different people, that simply doesn't work and you should not even attempt to do it. But if you can schedule it for like a 6 or 8 week block, then that class gets a full one-to-one experience for part of the year, which is much better than getting a shared experience more frequently, in my opinion. And that was the experience of a lot of other places that have tried that. So that's how I would recommend that people deal with less than one-to-one situation with iPads, not just like your laptops, but do it in bigger chunks. And then you can afford that reconfiguration time 2 or 3 times a year.
Matt asked about the 10 iPads are looking to start an after-school project using them for music making and other multimedia projects. And their goal, he says, is to inspire students, teachers, and parents to see what can be achieved with iPads in the classroom. What advice would you give to help make the project a success? And I'll say, I think his sentence about having their aim, to me, that's basically, that's their vision. I think that's the most important step is what they've said. That's our goal. Yep. And I think at that point you work through our deployment series and see what's relevant to you since it's just an after-school care club. Mm-hmm. But I think setting a goal on the front end and not just saying we're going to try this out to see what happens is smart.
Yeah, I can actually give you a real life example of this. Is something I'm teaching right now. In fact, I taught it today. I'm working. A number of our classes are doing a unit that I've written called Making Multimedia. And what we look at there is we're looking at different kinds of media. And there's some kinds of media that kids are very familiar with, such as, movies and TV and to a certain extent books and things like that. But what they're not familiar with are some other media like, say, a photo essay or a radio documentary. So what we do is I take it as read that they'd understand some kinds of media, and we look at others in some more detail. So I have them do listening exercises where they listen to a documentary on Radio 4, for example, or some other shows that I've found, and have them think about how you build that up. And then what I've had them do is write a radio script about something they're interested in, and then use GarageBand to record the radio script, and then have them add different kinds of sound effects and things as well, and background music, and build up a sort of short 5-minute radio program. And that's step one in that module. The next step is I have them use their iPad to go and make a photo essay. And then they use Keynote to put that together. So you just, fill 10 slides with pictures, full size, and just write a caption across the bottom. And then you've got a photo essay done in Keynote. And then the final part of that project is to use Keynote again. But what I set them to do then is I ask them to imagine they're making an interactive display for a museum. You've seen the kind of thing like a touchscreen, you walk up to an exhibit, you tap it and you get more information. And if you look in Keynote, in the presenter tools, there's a feature called interactive hyperlinks. And what you can do there is you can create shapes and images on the Keynote slide that when you tap them, they jump you to other parts of the slide deck. So the user can actually use it interactively instead of having it presented to them. And what I do there is, having looked at audio and photographs, and then obviously they're more familiar with text and video, they can actually put together a whole multimedia project, a multimedia kiosk, if you like, based on some of that experience plus things they already know from outside the school. So that's just an example of how I do multimedia projects, using a couple of apps on the iPad and a lot of creativity and thinking from the kids and just a wee bit of guidance from myself as well. There you go.
Another one from Lawrence. This is more of a comment than a question. I mentioned on, I guess it was probably on episode 100, there weren't a lot of books published on iPad deployment, but he actually found two. And if I would have done a quick search, I would have found that. Mm-hmm. The first is called Going One-to-One iPads and Mobile Devices in Education by Brendan Fitzpatrick and Patrick Fogarty. The other one is Going One-to-One Lessons Learned from a True One-to-One iPad Deployment, implementation by John Uding, I guess how you pronounce that, and Ann Stevenson. And he says there's a new iPad Education for Dummies book coming out in October. So, yeah, I was wrong. There are some books.
Yep. I know Brendan. I've met him. I've been to his school. And Brendan and Patrick, I think Patrick might have moved on, but they were both at Zavarian High School in New York as well. So this is my memories of New York from a couple of years back. But I visited their school just as they were going one-to-one. And really good school, really people that really know their stuff. So, definitely learn from those guys. There's also another one called the Lusaka Method, which is written by some people from the American International School in Zambia, where they've written up their approach to going one-to-one with iPad as well. And that's, I believe that's available in the iBookstore as well. So they're starting to get a number of sort of experience books based on what individual schools have done. And they're pretty valuable experience to read them and gain from them as well.
Another question is actually an old one. And I want to say this, it's C-O-R-R-I-E. So I'm going to say Corey Anderson. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Corey mentions that he teaches anesthesiology fellows at the University of Washington, and he would like to create a way to create and deliver tests electronically to the fellows. He said there's not a lot of Mac support at the institution, so he's creating the curriculum for the course basically alone. So requirements for the app, number one, security. We'd like to use the test biannually for the next 4 years to compare each student's progress. But he doesn't want the students to be able to copy the questions and give them to other students. Is there a way to prevent screenshots and printing of tests? And the second thing was format. What program would you use for creating multiple choice plus short answer questions? You considered SurveyMonkey, Pages, Numbers. Said a recent edition of MacLife detailed creating exams in Numbers. Have either of us tried Numbers to create exams? And the exam that ideally would have text, images, and videos in the questions. What other considerations am I missing? And that's obviously a very, very detailed question, so we obviously can't go super, super in-depth. But I believe you can prevent screenshots for supervised iPads, but I don't know that you could do that on the Mac. I don't think there would be a way to lock that out on the Mac.
Not that I know of, anyway. I would recommend looking at Google Forms for that. I believe that the latest updates to Google Forms allow you to do things like embed video and images into questions as well. So I think that would at least have all the capabilities that you need, that you're looking for in order to create the test you're looking for. Preventing screenshots is kind of more difficult, but what you would be able to do, I think, is if you do have Google Apps, and I'm not sure this is actually true in this case because it's you're talking about an institution, but for a school that does have Google Apps, you can actually require somebody to sign in with their ID, their institutional ID, before they can actually see the survey and take it. So that's something that might be worth looking at as well.
Yeah, of course, if Wufoo would be another option, that's a great form builder. Again, that's not going to have the login features that the Google Apps would. And that's one of the actually great features of Google Survey, is requiring a sign-in.
Yeah, and automatically gathering the user's ID as part of the response.
That's useful. So next thing is actually a comment from Patrick. It says, for a coding app that you can do higher-level programming, look at Codea. I guess that's how you say it.
Yep.
And so that's Codea by Two Lives Left, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. I think we talked about that on a previous episode. We're not Accidental Tech Podcast and have so much follow-up that we have to go through it every single week.
I've used Codea in the past. I haven't looked at it for maybe a year now, but when I used it, it was really good for sort of doing graphical routines and things like that. But at the time, our programming curriculum was a lot of kind of text input and interactive keyboard stuff, and it wasn't quite as well attuned for that because it was kind of assuming graphical input of some kind, like interactive input. But I think it certainly has been actively developed since then, so there's a number of good options there for things that you could do.
Last question, again, is from Lawrence Jones. It's a question about assigning activities, assessing them, moving back and forth between student and teacher. What do we do here? What do you recommend? And I think there are multiple ways, and a lot's going to depend on your organization. I mean, so many of our questions are organization dependent. Mm-hmm. Right off the bat, you could use Google Drive, Google Classroom, or you could use Shobi.
Yep. And the other one you could use, of course, is AirDrop, if everybody has similar hardware, or at least hardware that has that capability. And that's certainly what I do a lot of that, particularly for bigger files. Shobi is good for smaller files, but depending on your internet connection, it could sometimes, say you've got 20 kids in the classroom, you're like, right, kids, all upload your finished videos to Shobi. And it's not Shobi's fault, but your internet connection is going to hit the floor at that point as, 20 times 400 megabytes tries to get up to Shobi. So sometimes local AirDrop is actually a better approach just for those very large files as well.
Yeah, I had a teacher that got an iPhone 6 the day it was released, and she needed to get me a video that she'd recorded when I put it on our website. She was like, what's the best way to send that to you? And I just walked down her classroom, opened up AirDrop, sent it to me. A couple of seconds later, I had it and walked away. We use Vimeo to host our videos. So I'm signed into the school Vimeo account, because a little weird thing is you cannot upload videos inside the Vimeo app. You can only upload using the native iOS share sheet. So I'm signed into the school one, hit upload, off to the races, get an email an hour later that's been processed. So AirDrop is you know, obviously it is peer-to-peer, and that can make large transfers very, very fast.
Yep. It's another one of those Apple technologies. It's great when it works.
Asterisk when it works. Because I've seen, I was at a conference recently and trying to airdrop contact information to someone I'd met, and just didn't work. Like, just literally did not work. Couldn't even tell you why.
Yeah. Usually you end up just having to reboot the device to get that stuff back as well, which is
crazy. It's kind of my fear for Apple Pay, and it's been perfect so far. Like, mm-hmm. the first time it doesn't work, it's just easier to use your credit card from then on. And a lot of times, like, if AirDrop is flaky for sharing contact information, it's easier just to text them your V card at that point.
Yeah, because you're the guy who's like, hey, let's use AirDrop. And then 5 minutes later, you're standing there still trying to discover each other, and you're just embarrassed.
The rumor bump?
Yep. Bump.
It's like, do you have bump? No. Yes? Okay, let's try that. It didn't work. Let's just, you can text me my information.
I remember doing that with a guy I was at a conference with, and he was like, oh, let's use bump. And I was like, I don't have bump. And he's like, well, you better just stand there and download it. I'll just wait for you a while. And I was like, dude, could you not just, like, email it to me? But yeah. So yeah, that's one way that we do that is AirDrop is pretty good for the big files most of the time.
That's all the feedback I think we have. Obviously, there's a contact information at outofschool.net, so we don't always answer right away. So if you've got something question for us that's maybe a little bit more pressing, I would recommend Twitter is the fastest way to reach one of us.
Yep.
But we typically, every few months, we'll kind of go through the out-of-school mailbag, as we like to call it.
Most definitely. So will we wrap up there, Bradley?
Yes, we've got a special episode next week. I have a special guest that will be on with us talking about something incredibly fun.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that. And then we're going to take a couple more weeks off over Christmas, and we'll talk to everybody in the new year.
Have a good week, everybody.